And welcome to this week's edition of By the Book. I want to thank our friends at Koren Publishers and Magid Press, who again continue to provide us with amazing guests as we explore the world of Torah scholarship. And our guest this week is no stranger to my wonderful audience. Rabbi Shlomo Ritzkin is a widely respected spokesperson and activist for modern Orthodoxy in Israel. Serves as chief rabbi of Efrat and chancellor of the Or Torah Stone Institutions, a network of high schools, colleges, seminaries, and rabbinical schools. Before moving to Israel in 1983, he was associate professor at Yeshiva University and the founding rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue in New York. Rabbi Shlomo Ritzkin's brand new book is the Bracious volume of Torah Lights, a biblical commentary. Bracious, confronting life, love, and family. You can check it out at Koren Publishers, korenpub.com. Again, it's a Magid Books release that is a Koren imprint. Rabbi Shlomo Ritzkin, a pleasure to welcome you back to the Nachum Segal Network.
It's a pleasure to be here, my friend.
Why'd you write the book?
Well, let me just clear the air a little bit. I wrote Torah Lights a long time ago, the Bereishit Torah Lights. What's come out is Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and just now is coming out within the next week or two, Deuteronomy. So in other words, Bereishit was the first, and Devarim finishes this section of my work, of my writing. In other words, the five books of Moses, in terms of my commentaries, at this point, is concluded.
So I apologize to straighten this out. Basically, I think I see where the misunderstanding is. We were sent Bracious because of the timeliness of having this volume in hand. And as you just mentioned, thank God, Torah Lights, the entire collection of your commentary on the five books of Moses is now has now concluded and, again, is available to everybody. I guess that's where the misunderstanding was, and I'm glad you cleared that up. So Torah Lights, then, instead of asking why you wrote it, go back in time and explain how it became a series.
Well, for the past, I would say, maybe 35, 38 years, I've been writing Parsha columns, a portion of the week, began with the Jewish week, and then it spread to some 30 newspapers internationally, and about 28 years ago to the Jerusalem Post. And after a while, people began asking me if it should come out in book form. So what I did was went over the list after, 20, 30 years of writings, and chose what I considered to be the best of them, and did a little rewrite, generally speaking. And that's how Bereishit came to be, and Shemot, and Vayikra, and Bamidbar, and Devar.
Am I right that Bereishit is, well, I don't want to say completely different, because obviously the Torah is filled with narratives all through the five books, but Bereishit in and of itself is a different type of book to comment on. Would that be an appropriate way of putting it?
Bereishit is probably, not probably, I think certainly, the greatest book in world literature. It deals, I say, in the cover reads, that Bereishit confronts life, love, and family. Mm. I think there's nothing more crucial to life than love and family. There's nothing more supportive and nothing more problematic than family, and more important. So that Bereishit has it all, has the drama, has the pathos, has sometimes even a little bit of comedy and tragedy. And from a Jewish point of view, the story of the Jewish people is the story of a family. And the continuity of the family is the hope of the Jewish people, because we're really an unfinished symphony.
Right.
We have a task, a world-given task, to become a great nation, and through us, for all the families of the earth to be blessed. We were given a divine mandate to teach the world compassionate righteousness and moral justice. Tzedakah u'mishpat. And the future of the world, we see it now, especially since this Iran treaty is come about, whether there will be a free world left or there will not be a free world left depends to a great extent on our being able to finish the unfinished symphony and do our job by teaching the world.
On God alone we cannot rely is what you're saying, right? We have a role
as
well.
The message of the Bible is that God made us his full partners to perfect the world in the kingship of the divine.
Right.
We've got to do the job.
Rabbi Shlomo Riskin is with us. Torah Lights, a biblical commentary now available in the 5 books. And, of course, as because of the time of year, focusing for a moment here on Bracious. Confronting life, love, and family. So, Rabbi Riskin, so many of our listeners and those who are readers of the Bible are quite familiar with the stories of Bracious. We know about some of the, what many people would call dysfunction, but I don't know if that's an appropriate term or a respectful term to use, of certain families that we read about in Bracious. I mean, how different, and again, please, I don't want to offend anybody or any higher being by putting it this way, but Bracious is filled with so many complicated family stories. How different would our history be if things went smoothly and families back then or in that era would have operated in a, I don't know, maybe a similar fashion to some of the more functional families of today?
Well, wait. First of all, Nachum, I would not call the biblical families dysfunctional.
Okay.
I think that they were towering giants in the Bible. We have to understand that. They were towering giants. They also were capable of making towering mistakes. Because one of the great things about the Bible is it portrays all of these giants in the fullness of their humanity as well, which is amazing as far as our lessons to be learned are concerned. But look, to give you one very small example, if it had been up to Isaac and not Rebekah, we'd be the children of Esau. And the characteristics of our people would be very different than they really are today. And one of the things I think that's worth mentioning is that the matriarchs seem to have it together much more than the patriarchs. Abraham might have even gone with Ishmael. Would that Ishmael live before you, Abraham says to God when he's told about Isaac. It's Sarah who sends Hagar and Ishmael out. It's Sarah who says that my son cannot inherit with the son of this handmaid. Now, what does she really say? Does she say, my son will not because I won't allow it and I'm going to have him banished? Or does she say, my son will never be able to inherit because Ishmael is one whose hand is over everything, is one who demands it all, is one who does not know how to share. And I believe that the latter interpretation is perfectly in consonance with the biblical words. And I believe that this is the amazing prophet of prophecy of grandmother Sarah, because the truth is that in contemporary times, since November 29th, 1947, the children of Ishmael have simply not been willing to share, and we have always been willing to share. Anyway, for me, the Bible is more contemporary, not only than this morning's New York Times, because that wouldn't be much of a kunz, but the Bible is even more contemporary than this morning's Wall Street Journal.
You know,
the Bible says it all, and the Bible could never have been written by human hands. The Bible is truly a magnificent, magnificent work of the divine.
You know, you have an article on Parshas Toldos that's entitled "With Whom to Make Treaties." Fascinating in light of the news of the last couple of days regarding the United States and its leadership regarding a treaty or an agreement with Iran.
Especially fascinating is, and that comes out from the Bible very well, most treaties fail for a very simple reason. You know, George Santayana said, the only thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history.
Right.
And it's so, so very true. You know, you don't know whether to laugh or to cry. Chamberlain, his last comment about everything that he did in order to have brought about the Second World War. Chamberlain said, everything would have been all right if only Hitler hadn't lied to me. Avimelech lies to Abraham. It's very rare that nations enter into treaties and mean to keep the treaties. Now, if you're talking about a treaty between the United States and Canada, if you're talking about a treaty between two nations that have built up many years of trust, that's understandable. But to believe Iran, and even the ink is not yet dry, and the Khomeinis are declaring in Iran that we now have the go-ahead to build the bomb. How naive can people be? But that's true. That's how it's been. And we seem to continually be making the same mistakes.
Rabbi Shlomo Riskin is with us. The series is entitled Torah Lights, a biblical commentary, the Bereishis subtitle, Confronting Life, Love and Family. You mentioned the role of the woman, or actually you were talking about how the matriarchs got it even more than the patriarchs did when it came to the destiny of the Jewish people. I think that would be the right way, one of the right ways of putting it. Is there even then today, since we learned of today's lessons from the Bible, is there even then today a much more important role for the woman or the mother of the family than the male or the father of the family when it comes to perpetuating Jewish tradition?
Look, I've always believed that. I have another book that I'm very surprised, really, at the kind of marvelous response it's receiving. Listening to God, which is rather biographical, autobiographical, and it's autobiography through story. And one of the points I make in terms of my early life is that my most profound influence was my grandmother, my maternal grandmother. I learned the world from her. As a young boy, when I was 10, my grandfather died. And my grandmother lived two blocks away. I was the only grandchild in day school. We grew up in Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn. And we were the only Caucasians on the block. I got along famously with the African-Americans, but the African-Americans and the Italians were constantly fighting, and they went to school with knives instead of with books. And my parents decided to send me to a day school, the Yeshiva of Brooklyn, a marvelous, marvelous principal, Rav Menachem Manis Mandel, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And my grandmother saw her choice, her chance, and she borrowed me from my mother every Friday, from Friday afternoon through dinner. We davened mincha together. I watched her ben shlicht. I saw her talking to God. I saw her talking to God as one would talk with to a very beloved and dear friend with a capital F. She poured out her heart. I once thought of writing a book about her. God was my psychiatrist, I would call it. And it was amazing. To this day, when I pray spontaneously to God, even in the Lokai Nitzor or Tachnun, when I pray spontaneously, I do it in Yiddish because that's how my grandmother did it. And I learned how to talk to God from her. And she was an amazing woman who knew Gemara, because her father was the Dayan in a small town, Lublin, in Poland. And he first, Rav Shlomo HaKohen Kowalski, I'm named after him. He was the Rabbiner of the Rabbiner. He was the Dayan of the town. And he first had four daughters, of whom my grandmother was the eldest. He very much wanted to teach a child Torah. He hoped for a son, but he had four daughters. And my grandmother very much wanted to learn. So he taught her first Chumash, Rashi, Ramban, Mishnah, and Gemara. When she left in 1922, she left with my grandfather for America, and she thought she would never see my great-grandfather again. She asked him to please take a picture for her. He was a Ger Chassid. Ger Chassidim didn't take pictures. So he said, a picture is a graven image. I won't take a picture. But I'll give you a shas. And you'll get to the New World, and you'll study Gemara there too. And whenever you open a Gemara, you'll think of me. Well, every Friday night at my grandmother's table, until my bar mitzvah, she made Kiddush. After my bar mitzvah, I made Kiddush. Of course, Shalom Aleichem. Eshet Chayu, Birkat Habanim, Kiddush Zmirot, and then we would study a portion of the week in Yiddish Deitch, and then we would begin Masechet Brachot from age 10 to age 20. When I was 20, we finished Masechet Brachot 10 years later. And my grandmother gave me the shas. But she was my first real Rebbe. And I have tremendous, tremendous faith in women as inculcating the tradition from generation to generation. And that's why it's so important for me to teach women Torah on the highest of levels.
Wow, now we understand why. What a profound impact. I guess you could say your grandmother was your Rebbe, or grandmother was your Chavrusa, either which way.
My Rebbe, without a question.
And I was going to ask you then about a female Torah leadership in general. Obviously, you've just explained most of it, but I want to say this in a way that won't offend half the population, but is there something about women in Torah scholarship that they bring to the table that men do not? Is there something unique about either, I don't know, their abilities, their background, the perspective they come from? Anything you could shed some light on in that regard?
You know, I was very privileged to have three rabbis. My Rebbe Mufak was Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And there are many stories about Rabbi Soloveitchik in the book also because of that. I did stage, apprenticeship, every Friday for a year with Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Soloveitchik's cousin. And he made the shidduch between the two of us. When I first took Lincoln Square, there were very difficult halachic questions. And Rav Soloveitchik said to me, you know, the world calls me the Rav, and Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Rosh Yeshiva. But the truth, he said, was, Rav Soloveitchik said, I'm the Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Moshe Feinstein was a Shtat Rav in Europe. And the tradition was that the Shtat Rav paskined, because he came in real contact with the people. The Rosh Yeshiva lived in the hallowed halls of the Beit Midrash. He came in contact with Talmid HaChachamim. And people to Paskin Shilas have to really come into contact with the average householder. And that was the Rav. So Rav Soloveitchik didn't enjoy Psika. He didn't enjoy Paskining. And he felt the expert was Rav Moshe. And when I got difficult questions from my congregation of Balei Tshuva mostly in the beginning, he sent me to Rav Moshe, and I spent a year with him, just in Pesach.
Right.
And then the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zichronam Levracha, three of them, Rav Soloveitchik having been the Lamdan Hador, and Rav Moshe Feinstein the Posek Hador, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Manhig, the leader of the generation, who took responsibility for every Jew. And I went to see him at every important juncture of my life and sought his advice. And I once had a yechidut with the Lubavitcher Rebbe for an hour and 55 minutes on the issue of women. And both the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Soloveitchik said almost the same words, that the greatest challenge facing the 20th century, and I would say now the 20th and 21st centuries, is the challenge of women and women leadership within Orthodoxy. It's in Bereshit that I speak about women leadership in terms of the role of Sarah and the role of Rivka.
Mm-hmm.
Undoubtedly, had it not been for Rebecca, for Mother Rebecca, we would all be the children of Esau, as I mentioned before. She was the one who understood better than her husband that Jacob Israel had to get the blessings and the birthright, with all the complexities therein. But in the Sefer Devarim, which just now is coming out, the book of Deuteronomy, I speak in halachic terms of women as halachic decisors, women making halachic decisions. And the fact is that it's certainly right for them to be able to do that. Just about all the Rishonim, the Sefer Achinuch, the Chidah, without exception, I don't know of anyone who disagrees that women who know halacha have the right to paskin halacha. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe quoted for me when we had this very long yechidot on women and ritual, he quoted Jeremiah 31, my favorite chapter in another Yirmiyahu in Jeremiah, the chapter that speaks about Mother Rachel crying, weeping over her children when they're going to be sent into Galut Bavel, the exile into Babylonia. And they would pass by Mother Rachel's grave, and she would pray to God to intercede. And God tells her, Yesh Sachar L'Pulatech, there's reward for your loving kindness. Your loving kindness and giving the signs to your sister and not embarrassing her under the nuptial canopy. You will be repaid. V'shavu vanim l'gvulam, their children will return to their boundaries of Israel. They'll return from the exile, the first as well as the second, as we see in our generation. And then the prophet Jeremiah goes on to say, because he's also the prophet not only of the destruction, he's also the prophet of the rebirth, Tkuma, of the resurrection, the rebirth of the Jewish people in Israel. And Jeremiah puts it very well. He says, Nekevat Sover Gaver, I see in the time to come, in the days of the Messiah, the woman will run circles around the man. Now, it's fascinating. This is generally used in order to be the source for a woman walking seven circuits. The bride walking seven circuits around the groom.
All right.
Under the nuptial canopy. And this is it. The real pshat, not that the man is the center of the woman's existence, because the woman is also the center of the man's existence. It's this pasuk, that Latid Lavo Bimot HaMashiach, the time of redemption, and the entire subject of the Jewish marriage ceremony is redemption, starting with the Badekin. When the rabbis quotes the pasuk, the verse concerning Rebecca, Achoteinu Atayi La'alfei Revava, you will become the mother of myriads of thousands, myriads of 10,000s. V'yirash Zar'ech Et Sha'ar Son'av, and your seed will inherit the gates of your enemies. That's Geula. And the whole wedding ceremony speaks of Geula. And the subject, certainly according to the Zohar HaKadosh, of the verse under the nuptial canopy, Blessed are you, O God, Makadesh Amo Yisrael Al Yidei Chupa V'Kiddushin, God who sanctifies his nation Israel through Chupa and Kiddushin. God takes Israel to wife. That's the bracha. God takes Israel to wife, that's redemption. And the Zohar HaKadosh explains, what does this mean? That the groom under the marriage canopy symbolizes God. Mm-hmm. And the bride, Knesset Yisrael, the historic nation of Israel. And our first redemption in Egypt, when we were still in diapers, was effectuated by our parent in heaven, by God, because we couldn't do it alone. So all the miracles, all of the plagues, the splitting of the Red Sea, etc. But Latid Lavo, the ultimate redemption, the woman will run circuits around the male. Knesset Yisrael will be the initiator of the redemption.
I'm curious if you've met women, female Torah scholars, who in fact do run circles around the men.
My beloved friend, you did, and a very beloved friend, I want you to know that my experience in teaching men and women is that when we're dealing with women who really want to learn, they run circles around men.
There you have it. Rabbi Shlomo Riskin is with us via telephone. We're talking about the amazing Torah Lights series, Torah Lights, a biblical commentary. The subtitle of Breishit is Confronting Life, Love, and Family. Breishit, Shmot, Vayikra, Bamidbar, all available. Devarim is forthcoming. The Torah Lights series is a brilliant a contemporary account by Rabbi Shlomo Riskin about our Holy Bible. It is a Koren Publications release. Go to korenpub.com. It's a Magid Press imprint. Again, Magid and Koren Books. You can explore all of them. Go to korenpub.com, korenpub.com. And now the entire series of Torah Lights is going to be available. The four that have already come out and the Sefer Devarim is forthcoming. So you'll have an opportunity to enjoy them all as one set. Rabbi Riskin, since it's that time of year when we're reading about Joseph and his key role in Egypt, let me ask a couple of things regarding history of the Jewish people of that era. First of all, you make a point in the Torah Lights entry that we saw. You make a point of mentioning and examining how there is such a thing as dreaming and paying attention to one's own dreams, and then there's another thing where one pays attention to the dreams of others, and that is of course what dominates this week's Sidra. This week's Parsha is where Yosef demonstrates not only the ability to focus on his own dreams, but comes across his incredible ability to focus on and interpret the dreams of others. So what is the difference between the two, and how does it manifest itself in that young part of our Jewish history?
What I try to say was that in Vayeshev, Yosef begins very much on top. And he ends pretty much at the bottom, prison, pit, prison. In the next parasha, in Miketz, he begins on the bottom and ends up on top.
Right.
When does someone go from top to bottom, and when does someone go from bottom to top? And I said, as you put it very well, in Vayeshev, Joseph is only interested in having others hear his dreams. He doesn't listen to them at all, to the others at all. And then he started out on top, but he went down to the bottom. In Miketz, he starts on the bottom, but goes up to the top, because that's when he spends so much time listening to other people's dreams and trying to help them realize their dreams. And that's when a person becomes great, when he can leave himself a little bit behind and truly reach out to others and help them with their dreams.
And we know that those results eventually became very, very important turning points in our history. It's amazing to me how quickly, in the span of just a few sentences, he becomes essentially the head of Egypt, just because of the ability to give this dreamlike advice to the leader of Egypt.
But you know, it's interesting. I spoke to my students about this. You know, there are two ways we're approaching Hanukkah. How do we look at Greek wisdom in general? And I was a Greek major in college. I find the Greek wisdom very fascinating as well. Plato, Aristotle, the Rambam, the Shmona Prakim is actually almost a word-for-word translation of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. To what extent do we incorporate, or can we incorporate, secular learning? And I believe it's very important to understand that it's Yaftalokim Liyafet. God will make Yafet, Greece, Yavan, beautiful and broad and inspiring. The Yishkon Bo'al Shem. And Yafet must dwell in the tent of Shem. Yafet must dwell in the tent of Shem. Some say, no. God will dwell only in the tent of Shem and have nothing to do with Yefet, and that would mean turning your back on the secular world completely. Yefet will dwell in the tent of Shem means engage Yefet, but bring him into your tent. Make sure that you filter out the parts of Yefet that are not proper in accordance with Torah, but you incorporate the parts of Yefet that will help you to understand Torah.
Mm.
And I gave them an example from Parashat Yeshiv that's in the book. Why are the brothers jealous of Joseph? Jealous unto death. I mean, you are talking about the Shiftei Kah, the future tribes of Israel, because of his dreams. They banish him. They want to put him into a pit. They sell him as a slave. They're thinking of murdering him. But I think if you understand Freudian dream analysis a little bit, if you understand that we are the stuff the dreams are made of, the Gemara in Brachot, the ninth Perek, talks about this a lot, that we dream at night about what we think about, sometimes even subconsciously during the day. The interpretation is as follows. The classical dream of the Jewish people was the dream of Father Jacob. A ladder connecting heaven and earth. God at the top of the ladder. Angels going up and down. There's a connection between heaven and earth. We have to make that connection. Vasuli mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham. We must make a sanctuary so that God will feel comfortable coming down to earth. Our task is to bring him down to earth. That's the great Jewish dream of the Holy Temple. Joseph has two separate dreams, one that deals with something earthly, the sheaves of grain, and the other that deals with something heavenly, sun, the moon, the stars. But they're two separate dreams. And in Joseph's dream, which is a negative dream in the sense that he dreams of agriculture, sheaves of grain. Israel was not known for agriculture. Israel was shepherding. Agriculture was Egypt. Joseph apparently, at least subconsciously, hankered for the powerful and wealthy Egypt, was impatient with a small shtetl Israel. And in the dream of Yaakov, God is at the center. And Jacob is only asking God to promise to return him safely to Israel. In the dream of Joseph, we never hear a word about Israel. And Joseph is at the center. And everyone is bowing down to Joseph. So that I would suggest that the dreams told the brothers that Joseph was not fit to be a leader, the wearer of the cloak of many colors, the heir to the legacy of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. He lost out in 2 points. He was an Egypt enthusiast instead of being an Israel enthusiast. And he was the center instead of making God as the center. So their anger against Joseph was mostly ideological and not even incorrect. Their actions were terribly incorrect. And their actions were terribly incorrect, you know, that I heard from Rav Yoel Ben-Nun. The only 2 full chapters in the Bible, from beginning of Bereshit to the end of Devarim, there are only 2 chapters in which God's name does not appear even once, chapters 37 and 38 in Parshat Vayeshev. It's like God is saying, I don't want to have anything to do with what the brothers did to Joseph. Because if Joseph was wrong ideologically, and he was, you don't cast a brother out. You don't throw a brother into a pit of snakes and scorpions. You don't sell a brother into slavery. You explain to a brother. You teach a brother. You work with a brother. Yosef ultimately does tshuva. When he stands before Pharaoh, he says, Elokim ya'aneh l'shlom paro. God will interpret the dream. It's not me. Joseph, after all of his peregrinations and all, everything that happens to him, he understands he's not at the center. He understands that God is at the center. And with his very last breath, the end of Bereshit, in Parshat Vayechi, at the end, Joseph asks that when the Jews return to Israel, his bones be returned with them. He understands that Israel is the vortex, that Israel is our real homeland. So Joseph does tshuva. The brothers could have brought him to tshuva without having thrown him into the pit, without having sold him into slavery.
Wow, what a fantastic analysis. And the one of the most frustrating things for those of us in contemporary life, where communication, I guess, is so much easier than in prior eras, why do you think he never contacted his father to let him know that he was, in fact, still alive?
I make a number of suggestions, but the suggestion that speaks most strongly to me, I think Nachum Leibowitz actually brings it, in the name of Thomas Mann. Now, when Joseph was in the pit, until that point, he basked in his father's love. He was certain that everybody loved him as much as his father loved him, because he was his father's darling, the beloved child of his father's beloved wife, Rachel. And he was smart, and he was good-looking. But in the pit, he realized, number one, how much his brothers really hated him. He was oblivious to that before. Otherwise, he wouldn't have run after them and told them of his dreams and just aggravated it more. He didn't understand how much they hated him. When he understood, his first reaction was, I hate my brothers. If they could hate me to this extent, I never want to see them again. And one more thing he understood, that his father's public extra love for him, favoritistic love for him, that caused the brothers to be so upset with Joseph. He understands in the pit that his father was responsible for the hatred of the brothers. And he says in the pit, I will never make contact with my father's house again. Not with my father, and not with my brothers. If this could be the result of the years of my childhood in my father's house. And I think that's why he never gets in touch with his father. When he meets the brothers, he weeps. And I also have a piece in this based on what I heard from my Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik. Tears often tell us about the deep feelings we have. Often when we don't even know we have those feelings, the tears that well up uncontrollably, they tell us about those feelings.
Wow.
And Joseph, when he sees his family, they come to buy food, he recognizes them, although they don't recognize him. He always weeps because he really has strong feelings, especially for Benjamin. So first he figures maybe he'll get Benjamin alone. And then ultimately he makes a rapprochement with the entire family. And of course everything ends with a tremendous, tremendous rapprochement forgiveness.
Right.
And the importance of family forgiveness on every level.
So maybe maybe Joseph and his brothers had more love and family than any of them thought they had.
Absolutely true. And the family becomes united at the end, which is a beautiful ending.
Breishit, Confronting Life, Love, and Family. Rabbi Shlomo Riskin is with us via telephone. I thank him so much for all this time. I wanted to touch for a moment, Rabbi Riskin, in addition to all your incredible work with our Torah Stone and the amazing Torah commentary and so many other books and Sfarim that you're responsible for. I noticed that you're going to be leading a journey to Germany and Israel. This is happening in the month of May 2014, and under the leadership of Artur, I should say under the banner of Artur Stone, you'll be leading a Germany to Israel trip May 19th through the 28th of 2014. And in that, it's not just a tour of Germany. You actually have the students that are participating in the revival of Jewry in Germany. I point that out because some people always question whether it's a good idea, a bad idea, if it's worth feeding the economy of countries like Germany. Is it a good idea or a bad idea to visit Europe after all that went on? In your case, you're going to be providing everybody with the opportunity to see firsthand what amazing Jewish teachers are doing right now in Germany in terms of building a Jewish community.
Yes, what's really happening is we're celebrating our 30th anniversary, Or Torah Stone. And we have, thank God, 19 institutions. From junior high school through to rabbinical seminary and women's seminary, and teaching women on the highest of levels, and producing rabbis all over the world, literally North America, South America, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. And we have rabbis in Eastern Europe. We have a rabbi in Krakow. The rabbi in the city in the Ramah, of the Ramah, the first rabbi after the Holocaust. And we have rabbis in Germany. And when I think of what has happened during these last 30 years, what's happened during the generations of my life, what's happened is a movement from the lowest period of Jewish destruction to the highest possibilities of Jewish renaissance, rebuilding, and recreation. And what's happened especially is, B'chol dor v'dor omdim aleinu l'chaloteinu, v'akosh baruch hu matzileinu miyadam. I'm starting with Germany, and we have 11 rabbis in Germany. You know, there are two Jewish communities that are growing today. The Jewish community in Israel, obviously, from 600,000 in 1948 to 6 million today. And the Jewish community in Germany, largely due to Russian influx. Mm. But it's growing, unlike most other Jewish communities. Now, our rabbis talk a lot about Israel and want to get the Jews to go back to Israel, and certainly not to stay in Germany, and that's legitimate. But at the same time, the message is an amazing message. There were 6 million horrific korbanot, kiddushim, in the Holocaust. But we won the war. Hitler and Nazism is dead. And Am Yisrael Chai, even in Berlin, even in Munich, even in Darmstadt, even in Frankfurt. We won the war. There's only one victor. Very often there are terrible, terrible, terrible losses. I hate to call losses casualties. There's nothing casual about death. We had 6 million terrible, terrible losses. But we nevertheless won the war. Torah, what Hitler was fighting a war against the last Jew, against Judaism. And in his own town, where his own bunker, suicidal bunker is, Judaism is flourishing. Now this is an amazing message about the power and strength of Judaism. About the fact that God and Torah never let us down. And that's the movement from Germany to Israel. And we won the war even in Germany, but we see the tremendous recreation and renaissance, obviously only in Israel. And so it's from Germany to Israel.
And the trip actually ends, if I have my dates correct, on Jerusalem Unification Day, Yom Yerushalayim in Israel.
That's correct. That's correct.
That's pretty amazing, and it's quite a statement. Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, we are highly recommending Torah Lights, a biblical commentary. The Breishit subtitle is Confronting Life, Love, and Family. It's available in Breishit Shmot Vayikra Bamidbar. Devarim is forthcoming. You can check it all out at korenpub.com, korenpub.com. It's a Magid Books release, and it is, which is, of course, a Magid Book is an imprint of Koren Publishers, and you could check it out and enjoy. And Rabbi Riskin, we always love checking in with you to find out what's happening and what the and how in fact you continue to associate the amazing Bible of ours, our greatest of documents in our history, to what is happening today, and you've done that again today for us, and we greatly appreciate it.
Well, the best, Nachum. It's a pleasure being with you, and continue to grow from strength to strength.
Amen. Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, widely respected spokesperson and activist for modern Orthodoxy in Israel, serves as chief rabbi of Efrat and chancellor of the Or Torah Stone Institutions, a network of high schools, colleges, seminaries, and rabbinical schools. Before moving to Israel in 1983, Rabbi Riskin was the associate professor at Yeshiva University and the founding rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue in New York. For Rabbi Riskin, Torah is at once the oldest and the most contemporary document directing human lives. In Torah Lights, the highly acclaimed five-volume Parshat HaShavua series, Rabbi Riskin helps each reader extract deeply personal contemporary lessons from the traditional biblical accounts. As Rabbi Riskin writes in the introduction to Torah Lights, the struggle with Torah reflects the struggle with life itself. The ability of the Torah to speak to every generation and every individual at the same time is the greatest testimony to its divinity. Torah Light is available in Breishit Shmot by Yikra Bamidbar. Devarim is forthcoming. I thank our friends from Koren Publishers for providing Rabbi Riskin as a guest so we could discuss this amazing work, Torah Lights, with him. The entire series, of course, is highly recommended. We paid special attention today to Torah Lights, Breishit, Confronting Life, Love, and Family, obviously because of the time that we are in right now. And anybody who would like information about Rabbi Riskin's or Torah Stone organization or the trip that he's doing to Germany and then to Israel in the month of May, you can go to the Or Torah Stone website and you can get all the information you need. Koren Publishers has information about Torah Lights, a biblical commentary. All you have to do is go to korenpub.com. That's korenpub.com. And you'll be able to get all the info regarding Torah Lights. Again, that's korenpub.com, korenpub.com. Koren Publishers, or I should say Magid Books, which is the official imprint of this work of Torah Lights, is an imprint of Koren Publications. You've been listening to Buy the Book here at the Nachum Segal Network. And we thank all of you for tuning in on a weekly basis, Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, right here at jmnam.org and nachumsegal.com. Thank you.